The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for December 23rd, 2017. And with just 2 days until Christmas, I hope you've done all your shopping and are getting ready to spend some downtime relaxing and enjoying the season. Perhaps you are thinking about the new year and what it might bring. It's my hope that it brings you all peace, good health, and a very safe 2018. So tonight I'll be speaking with Keith Laughlin, the president of Rails to Trails, David Coventry, an award-winning author, and in an encore presentation, I'll be replaying cycling's foremost storyteller's piece, Nice Wheels, by Maynard Hirshon. Beginning with Keith Laughlin, who is the president of Rails to Trails and the guy I go to for an insider's look at Washington, D.C., I thought I'd offer one more end-of-year gift-giving idea. I don't know how many trails you've ridden or plan to ride in the future, but Rails to Trails has done so much good in the realm of developing safe and fun places to ride coast to coast here in the U.S. From Maine to California, from dirt and gravel to paved asphalt, Rails to Trails has developed thousands of great places to ride, walk, and hike. Keith will give us a wrap-up of 2017 and a look into the future as we head on into 2018. Then it's all the way around the world to New Zealand, where I catch up with award-winning author David Coventry. In his debut novel, The Invisible Mile, David lays bare the pain and agony of a 1928 Tour de France in a first-person account by an unnamed protagonist. Along with his teammates, our rider's first tour on the continent reveals a rash of powerful human emotions from fear and pain to determination and hope as he explores his own humanity through the gritty miles of this post-war Tour de France. While David claims the book is not about cycling, I think the details that surround the human drama say more about cycling than we ordinarily experience in most cycling writing. Finally, we hear Maynard Hirshon's great story, Nice Wheels. I usually replay it around the holidays as a reminder not only of how bike shop owners really think and feel, but of what a gift given freely and without expectations is what embodies the essence of the holidays. So first up, it's my year-end conversation with Keith Laughlin. Hi, Keith. Happy holidays. Welcome back to the Outspoken Cyclist.
Thank you, Diane. It is always a pleasure.
Well, we usually talk about what's happening in Washington, D.C., about transportation and that kind of thing. But this is part of our charitable giving show. And I wanted to include Rails to Trails as our listeners ponder year-end charitable giving. So what were your goals in 2017 for Rails to Trails?
Well, we had several, but two of the big ones were that we, on the policy side, we had two big goals. One is we had to prepare for a new administration coming in. And so we've been tracking what they're doing. And they had made noises at different times about an infrastructure bill. That has not happened. If it had, we were prepared, and we will be prepared next year. In addition to that, though, because there hasn't been that much going on in Washington, we made a big effort in 2017 to increase trail funding at the state level. And I'm proud to say that through our efforts, we increased state funding for trails by $400 million
wow.
in 2017. And that was primarily in six states that we really put the focus on. And that's not just us. That's working with our local partners on the ground, you know, because we never do any of this by ourselves. It's working with other bike groups and other trail groups to get that done. So that was a big accomplishment.
$400 million, that's a huge amount of money.
Yeah, and that's all coming through the states. That's not federal money. We're still getting federal money, too. So, yeah, this stuff is popular. People want this in their communities. So, you know, it's not like we're trying to sell people something they don't want.
Right.
The other big thing that we had is that we launched a new program this year called Trail Nation. And what we're doing is that we've got eight kind of mega projects across the country where we're trying to demonstrate how you build low-stress bike networks in your communities. And so some of these projects were have been underway for a couple years, but we launched two new ones this year, and we sort of launched it all as a package. And so we now have eight of these underway, and we're going to add four more projects over the course of the next 3 years. So we have a dozen of these big projects where we're trying to create active transportation systems in metropolitan areas.
Give us an example of one.
Well, let me quickly give you a couple. One is like in Baltimore. We have a 35-mile loop, and it's both the smallest one and the most urban. And so it's sort of a loop around the city that will connect about 100 neighborhoods with the trail. Another one is one in your backyard. It's called the Industrial Heritage Trail Coalition, and that is to build a 1,400-mile trail system across four states. And that is western Pennsylvania, eastern Ohio, West Virginia, and even going into a corner of New York. And so that will largely be rural, but it will also connect, for instance, it'll connect Pittsburgh to Cleveland.
Nice. We like that. That's really exciting. So now will that dump into the trail that goes down to Washington?
Yes. That's part of our goal is you can now get from D.C. to Pittsburgh, and this is getting us from Pittsburgh to Cleveland. So you'll be able to get on your bike in Cleveland and ride all the way to D.C. and visit us here.
We would love to do that. We would just love to do that. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Keith Laughlin about Rails to Trails and what's happened in 2017. We're going to look forward to. Did you have a second one that it was Baltimore and then the Cleveland one. Yeah, those are cool.
Yeah, and the first one's very urban, and the second one is really quite rural, connecting these big cities together.
I want to give listeners an idea of what happens when they include Rails to Trails in their giving plans. So what are some of the ways people can support Rails to Trails? I know it's not all money. There are other things they can do.
Yes. And on the money side, we always need that support. And you can join as a basic member for $18 a year, or we have a sustaining members that can go from $5 to $10 a month. And we have a Trailblazer Society for those who are able to give it $1,000 and above. But there are other ways to make a contribution. A lot of that's also on the advocacy side. It's contacting your state and local and federal representatives whenever there's a big issue that will support cycling.
And we know that there are a few of those. Actually, there are a lot of those.
Yeah, there are a lot of those, and it's happening all the time, and we're sending out action alerts on a regular basis, and we have on our list about 150,000 people who support us either financially or by taking policy action on our behalf.
What about actual trail work? Can people actually work on trails through Rails to Trails?
We actually have a new capability to be able to now connect people better to local trails. And this is mostly for maintenance, not for trail building. But there's a lot of people who, trail managers that like do an annual cleanup, that sort of stuff. We now have built on our website a mechanism where we can connect some of our trail users with people managing trails for trail cleanup days, to do rides, all kinds of that sort of thing. So we try to make that connection between our members and the people who are actually managing the trails at the local level.
Do you have any idea of how many people use the trails on a year-to-year basis? Can you pinpoint or at least give us some indication of how many people use Rails to Trails facilities?
I wish I really knew. The challenge is that we've got more than 1,500 trails, and very few of them actually keep track of their counts. But there are enough that do have counts that we're confident of seeing tens of millions of people per year, which means that we know it's probably somewhere between 20 million and maybe 100 million.
Wow.
It's a lot.
Yeah, I'd say so. Is there any way of gauging the economic impact of trails?
Yes, we've done studies in lots of places across the country that have looked at either the economic benefits of bicycle tourism, which are very large in some places, and then we've also been able to quantify what is the economic benefit of taking cars off the road, of reducing air pollution, of reducing healthcare costs. Those are all things that are part of the case that we make for building more trails.
So what's happening for 2018, assuming that, you know, the infrastructure thing sort of stays the same, meaning nothing's happening? What kinds of things are happening around the country for Rails to Trails? What are your goals for 2018?
Well, we've got it. Part of it is to just keep moving ahead with this Trail Nation program, which is really gathering steam. And we're going to have a summit in Milwaukee in June, where we'll be inviting about 100 trail leaders from around the country in an effort to move these projects forward. And we'll have people from 20 different places around the country who are all trying to build trail and active transportation systems. And then there's two other things that are going to be big priorities that unfortunately I can't provide detail on yet. I have to keep it a little quiet, but we're going to announce toward the end of next year, probably the biggest project we've ever done. So next year at this time, I'll be able to give you all the details. We're doing a lot of analytical work where we're beginning to measure how the connectivity of a local low-stress bike network. And we're going to be launching an effort like that that I can't get into the details yet, but it's going to be in Cleveland.
Oh, cool. I get to be there.
Yes, you get to be there. So we'll plug you into that effort. But that's we've done a lot of work in Ohio over the years, and I think we'll have an increasing focus in Cleveland over the next year.
Wow, I feel really lucky. That's awesome. I'll get to see you like more than once every 2 years. That'll be nice too. So I guess the last thing we really need to tell people is how they can find out more about Rails to Trails. What's on your website? I know you have the Trail Link system, which is really kind of cool. I was playing with it before I came to the studio today. Just a little bit of general stuff on what people see when they log on to railstotrails.org.
Right. When you go to railstotrails.org, there's sort of three different things we focus on. One is trail use, and that's where you'll find those links to Trail Link. And that is we have 30,000 miles of trail mapped that's available for people to look at on our Trail Link website. And then on our Rails to Trails website, we also have a lot of information in two different categories. One is on the trail building side. We have a toolbox of tools for how to build rail trails that is accessed by communities around the country. And then we have a policy section where we really use it as an advocacy center for when we're building support on the policy side and on the funding side for building more trails. And so it's for trail users, it's for trail builders, and it's for trail advocates.
You know, I wasn't going to get into politics, but I guess one of the things I'd like to know, because I know Earl Blumenauer is still in Congress, is there still an effort in Washington a lobbying effort for this infrastructure bill and for more money for, you know, cycling and pedestrian?
I think that remains to be seen. I think that the congressional leadership really hasn't defined what their objectives were going to be after the passage of the tax bill. And so that's just wrapped up, and they are now focused on trying to keep the government open. And I think after the holidays, I think in January, we will hear more about what their legislative priorities are for the coming year. I would really think that the infrastructure bill would be part of that, because it has been one of the pieces of the president's agenda that really hasn't been addressed at all. But we'll just have to wait and see. I think they'll have to define their priorities.
I guess. Well, Keith, why don't we give our listeners the information about how to find out more about Rails to Trails, where they can go, and then I'll send you back to your regular job.
Well, thank you, Diane. And it's very easy. It is just Rails2Trails, all one word, .org. And on that site, you will find places where you can find information about where to find a trail, for how to be an advocate for trail, or how to donate to the organization.
Well, I appreciate talking to you always. I always learn so much. I'm really excited that there's a program that's going to be happening here in Cleveland, and I'm going to get to be able to participate in some way or another. I hope it's not June 24th. That's the only thing. We have a ride coming up.
No, it'll be throughout the year.
Oh, even better. Well, that's awesome. Well, Keith, I hope you have a wonderful holiday and a very happy and safe and healthy New Year.
The same to you, Diane.
All right.
Thank you.
You take care.
Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye. Keith Laughlin joined me from the offices of Rails to Trails in Washington, D.C. If you are interested in becoming a member of the organization or volunteering to help build and maintain trails in the area or get involved in advocacy, you can log on to rails2trails.org. Let's take a short break, and then it's off to New Zealand to speak with author David Coventry about his award-winning book, The Invisible Mile. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
Hey, this is Rose from Rose's Turn on WJCU. May your holidays be merry and bright this season.
We're back, and it's off to New Zealand via Skype to speak with the author of the award-winning novel, The Invisible Mile, David Coventry. Hello, David. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me.
It's my pleasure. So I'd like to know a bit about your background and the hill where you live in Wellington. You live on the side of a hill, it says.
Yeah. Is that on my bio?
It is, actually. It says... Born in 1969, Coventry lives and writes on the side of a hill in Wellington. So somebody wrote that on the jacket of your book.
that's really funny. That made it there. It's something that I wrote down as kind of an in-joke for something else, and somehow it made it into that bio. It's the thing about where I live in Wellington, New Zealand, if you live in Wellington, you live on a hill. it's a harbor city, and it just flies out of a harbor, and so it was just a little in joke. But it's beautiful. It's a really beautiful place.
So if it's Wellington, yeah. I see, it's not special that you live on a hill. Everybody lives on a hill. Is that your point?
Was my kind of joke. Yeah.
So
yeah.
You are in the middle of your summer this is the shortest day of the year for us here. Is it the longest day of the year for you? Evidently, that would be so, right?
Yeah. Well, yesterday was. We're a day ahead here.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're a day ahead. Yeah. You're a day ahead. Yeah. Well, let's talk about your book. So, can we talk? Well, actually, no. Let's not. Let's go back and talk about you, because I want more information about you, because I didn't learn as much from, you know, when publishers send me these books, they send bios and they send, you know, here are some questions you can ask the authors. Well, I like to do that stuff myself. But I don't know a lot about you, so why don't you tell me a little about David?
Sure. yeah, I live on a hill in Wellington. Yeah, no, I'm a writer. I used to be a film archivist. And before that, I was a sound engineer and a musician of sorts. And for the last few years, I've just been writing, and it's been my life, which has been quite a wonderful thing. My cat is probably going to interrupt us.
That's okay.
I'll give you that.
What's your cat's name?
Sandy.
We like cats.
Yeah. Every time I start talking at home on my own, she comes along and sort of nuzzles in and goes, "What's going on here?"
Yeah, right, so I'm sure exactly. That'll. Are you talking to yourself? What's wrong with you?
She doesn't
get it, you know, that there's another part of the conversation. I get that.
Well, I think she thinks I'm talking to my wife. That's my theory. Anyway.
Who doesn't happen to be there, right?
That's right.
At the moment. Yeah. Well, let's talk about your book. So The Invisible Mile, it's a novel, unlike many of the books I get to review and talk with authors about. There are not a lot of books about cycling, but the truth is this novel is not, as you said, not about bicycling, but it did win the 2016 Hubert Church Award for Fiction. What is the Hubert Church Award?
Oh, it's a book award here for best first novel. It won that back in 2016. And it was shortlisted for the big prize here in New Zealand. And apparently I was very close to winning that as well, but didn't. A friend of mine won that.
Well, at least it's somebody who's a friend, right?
Yeah, that's right. I was very thrilled for him. So that was nice. But it was a real thrill to win that award. And it sort of helped springboard the book outside of New Zealand. And it's been translated into... how many languages? Five, I think. And it's kind of available around the world, which is a thrill I never expected to have. It's been quite extraordinary.
Well, it's interesting because when I went to your website, David Coventry, I see the different covers of the book, which is interesting that they wouldn't. And I've encountered this before with books that are published in Europe as opposed to the U.S. They have different covers. And it never makes any sense to me. Why wouldn't they all have the same cover? But I guess I don't know. Do you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's a thing. Some publishers have a specific look they go for, like with there in the United States and Canada, it's Europa editions, and they have a lovely kind of stylistic thing that they go for that's actually designed in Italy. All their books are designed in Italy, as I understand it. There's a Spanish edition, which they have a very specific look for their editions, and I guess publishers they're trying to sell a book. And the way that they, you know, put a cover on a book in the way that they believe will sell the book to the people that they want to sell it to. So there's always going to be slight differences.
Well, I looked at the five covers and I like this one. So they were right.
Yes.
This one appeals to me. I like this cover.
Same.
So
I think it's the most relevant one, too.
It's the most what? Relevant?
Yeah.
What is The Invisible Mile? So that's the title of the book, The Invisible Mile. Tell our listeners what does that mean?
What does that mean? Okay. It's, here comes the cat. It's a space between, important things, things that we can't quite quantify, like, history and past, theory and fact, say religion and God, word and meaning, event and sublime, these kinds of things. And in the book, I think history and past and event and sublime, these are two very important ideas. The notion of how can you reconcile the histories that we have with the past that occurred that we can't quite access. We can never actually access the past. We can only write histories, and they're very different things. The past doesn't exist. It only exists in history. And, you know, this is something that's very interesting to me, and that's kind of the things I was trying to write about and using sport to do it.
Well, the setting is 1928 in Paris at the beginning of the Tour de France, so it's post-World War I. It's a group about a group or a team of cyclists who are actually brought to the continent from Australia don't speak French, which is part of the interesting part, this language barrier. And the first-person account is an unnamed cyclist. It's such an interesting way of looking at this. Set the background for the book for us. Tell us why this group – I mean, this actually – it's a historical novel. So this Ravat Wonder team, was there such a team?
Yeah, there was. There was. I prefer not to think of it as a historical novel. I prefer to think of it as a contemporary novel about history.
Okay. Well, that's a good way of catching it.
Yeah. The history behind the book. I had an idea. I used to work at the New Zealand Film Archive, and what was called the New Zealand Film Archive has changed its name since then. And I was the manager there, the research manager. And so all requests for footage came through me, and we had a fairly stringent thing about what people could use footage for and such forth. And there was a lot of, this was in 2012 when I started writing it. And we were getting a lot of requests for World War I footage. And I started to become concerned about kind of projects, the kind of histories and the kind of programs and the documentaries and whatever people were going to be using this footage for. And I started thinking about the construction of World War One now, how we were going to rebuild World War One in the consciousness of the people, you know, around us through film and stuff. And so this was on my mind a lot. And I was itching to start writing a book. And then one day, somebody came along, and it was the guy from The Amazing Race. Do you know that program?
I do.
Yeah. He's a New Zealander, and he came to the archive asking for footage of the cyclist called Harry Watson, who I'd never heard of. And I said, I did some research for him and stuff and said, no, I'm afraid there's absolutely nothing. And so off he went, and I didn't really hear from him again. But I went home that night, and I sort of did some research on this Harry Watson guy because it sort of perked my interest. It's like, who's this famous guy I've never heard of? And nobody else that I know of had heard of. And he turned out to be this guy who is New Zealander who'd been on the first English-speaking team to ride on the Tour de France. And I was like, huh. That's really interesting. And I literally just started writing the book then and there. Because I had, I just sort of, one of the guys in this it was a real team who went in 1928, or they were a real team. And there was only four of them. And as you can imagine, a four-man cycling team is not going to cut it against the 10-man French teams. So they struggled, but they were interesting. There's all these things that I saw there on this guy's Wikipedia page. He had the nickname of being the priest, and another guy in the team was actually a veteran of World War One, and it just triggered off all these things that I've been thinking about for a long time. And so I started writing it, and very quickly I discovered I had to invent a fifth person to be the narrator. Originally, I started writing it from this guy Harry Watson's perspective, but if you read the book, you'll see it has this very kind of poetic voice and kind of pseudo philosophical kind of point of view. And yeah, it was apparent to me that this had to be. A fictional character. I couldn't put this onto this Harry Watson person.
Poor Harry, right? Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with David Coventry. He lives in Wellington, New Zealand, on the side of a hill. And his new book, which isn't so new right now, but it's new to us, is The Invisible Mile. It's a novel. And it is not truly about cycling, but to me, it sort of is, because I think that the bicycle has a really important role to play. It's the Tour de France. 1928 is the setting. About a team called Ravat Wonder, which actually was a team, but we're talking about a fictional protagonist. And one of the things that sort of runs through the book is this language barrier that, you know, I mean, we speak English. It was the first English-speaking team, and here they are in France and trying to get along and learn and ride and race and pace and, you know, and there is a language barrier. Why was it so relevant for the story to have this kind of setup between the French and the English?
Yeah, it's about unknowns. I mean, to tell the truth, an actual fact, Harry Watson and Herbert Offerman, the two best writers in the team, they actually were quite good at French. Their French was actually, they learned it really quickly. They had a capacity to do that. But my narrator is clueless about it. He has no capacity to learn language. So just to clarify that. But language barrier. Well, it's very much talks to the barriers between, again, going back to the history and past thing, the word and meaning thing. It's impossible to sort of to get across that barrier to push through it. And so that was just another device to sort of present this idea of not being able to access the past. You're only it's quite a dreamlike book in many ways, and that's kind of part of it. He's living it within his own kind of language and it's a very descriptive book also, and it's describing the land, and it's describing the people, and it's describing all the things he can see. But there's something stopping him from being able to access it fully, and language is definitely one of those.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. So I wanted to ask you about the people who went with this team. Were they real people, or were they part of the sort of fictional character, our narrator, like his sister?
Oh, yeah, no. So the four other people in the Rivat Wonder team, they're based on real people.
Okay.
Many of the riders in the tour are based on real people, but the main characters pretty much are all fictional. There's a famous French writer, Louvier. He's fictional. His cousin Celia, she's fictional. His sister, fictional. So the main protagonists in the book are all fictional. I mean, Harry Watson has a big part to play in the book, and he's kind of the only one who I kind of invented, you know, which was interesting, you know, because his family is, you know, his grandchildren have read the book and stuff. it's quite a strange thing when the book came out, and I kind of came across the fact that his family were living in my city and things like this, and it was it's like, ah, there's actually a reality to this book I hadn't actually conceived of.
Right, it's fiction until it's not, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Right,
that's right.
So this book actually has been out a couple of years, and we will tell people how to get a copy of it. Again, it's got some wonderful accolades, and I think that what they're saying is true. One New Zealand listener, which is interesting. I don't know why that's what it is. Beautifully and brutally poetic. A truly extraordinary first novel. And you know, reading it, I don't know what your other writing has been, but it seems like you've probably written other novels before. So to have this one be your first one is pretty spectacular. It's very literary. I really like the way you wrote it.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's always lovely to hear these things. It never gets boring, I can tell you.
No. That's good.
Yeah. Thank you. No, it's. I did write a novel prior to this. It was kind of like my practice novel. I did an MA here in Wellington, a very prestigious MA actually. It's been produced a lot of great novelists and Booker Prize winners and such forth. And yeah, I wrote a book during that, but it was very much my practice book, and it allowed me to develop my chops as such to be able to write this book.
What are you working on,
you know,
now? Go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's all right. I was just going to say something about the, it's not really about cycling, but I mean, most of the book takes place on a cycle. So obviously there is, it can't not be about cycling. There is a lot of cycling in it. So that cycling is definitely there. And I really loved writing the cycling passages. They're a lot of fun to write. And I discovered there's a really close connection between writing and cycling. It's all about cadence. It's all about rhythm. And I was kind of like talking to myself as I was writing. That's what the writing was. It was just talking back to itself. It's this constant rhythm that was going on. And it was really great fun to do. So there is a lot of cycling in this book, yeah.
That's very interesting. The cadence of writing and the cadence of cycling. So do you ride? Are you a cyclist?
I haven't been in great health for the last 5 years, and I unfortunately can't ride anymore. But I used to. I mean, I do like cycling, but I'm not a cycle nut. But members of my family definitely are cycle nuts.
You don't have to be crazy nuts to ride, but well, maybe.
No, you don't. But no, I do love cycling. It's a really beautiful thing, and it's. But yeah, there was a different sort of relationship between the two. I didn't even think of before I started, but as soon as I started, I was like, oh my God, you know, these are so connected, these two things. And, and it was nice. There was one reviewer, I think it was, Marcus Zusak, the guy who wrote, I've forgotten his name. Anyway, and he said, what I love about this is that it's what it feels like to write. And I guess only writers can know that, but that was a huge sort of accolade for me, was that, you know, he was this famous writer and he was saying this book feels like what it is to write, and that was really, really nice.
That's an interesting statement. Yeah, so one of my favorite accolades for the book comes from the Sydney Morning Herald, and all of our listeners will appreciate this. These writers make Lance Armstrong look like a goody two shoes, an odyssey told with symbolic force and poetic finesse. Given all the trouble that Lance Armstrong's in only all the time, that's going to be an interesting perspective for people who pick up the book to read it.
Well, these guys were just
we're not giving it away. They have to read it for themselves. What are you working on now, David?
So yeah, I'm writing about well, a writer never tells, but no, I'm writing another book with similar concerns and themes, but it's about punk rock, which is one of my deep loves. So
interesting.
Completely different to cycling. But
you didn't know I was going to ask you these questions, but I am going to ask them to you. What's your favorite food?
Salad on toast is up there. and curry. I've never considered this question before. I kind of like all foods.
Okay. It's a cop-out, David, but all right, I'll take
it. Yeah, sorry.
That's all right. And see, you already told me you have a cat, so I can't ask you if you have any pets because I already know that. And now you told me that you like punk music, punk rock, so that kills the other two questions. It's always, what's your favorite food, what music do you listen to, and do you have any pets? And so the only one you didn't answer was the one about food, so I figured I'd ask it.
I have to think about that for a long time. And toast is
wait, what is that? What do you mean salad on toast?
You make a salad.
Yeah.
You know, really, really good salad.
Yeah.
And then you dump it on some really, really good toast, you know, some good bread which you've toasted, and it's just with some olive oil, it's just really, really great.
Well, I'll have to try that.
Meals.
I make great salads, but it never occurred to me to dump them on toast. We usually just eat them in a bowl.
Well, yeah, exactly. But it's the next day. It's the next day thing.
Oh, I see. All right. Let's tell some listeners where they can get a copy of your book, The Invisible Mile by David Coventry. Where can they get it?
I hope you can buy it in the bookstore.
You assume that there are still bookstores. There are some.
Yeah. I guess you can order it online from any of the major online book retailers.
Like Amazon.
I'm sure you could order it from Europa Editions.
Well, that's another thing. I've never heard of Europa Editions. This is the first book I've gotten from them, and again, it's a beautiful cover. I love it. Well, and the title. Oh, it was Marcus Zusak. That's who you were talking about. He was the author of. He's the author of The Book Thief.
Yeah, that's the guy.
He calls it beautiful and ultimately transcendent. There's a perfect thought on sport, humanity, or endurance on just about every page. So interesting book. I really appreciate you writing it, and I appreciate you taking time to talk with me about it. I hope you have a wonderful holiday, and I'll look for your next book when it comes out.
Great. Thank you very much for having me.
And thank you. You have a wonderful new year.
You too.
Pet
Cheers.
Pet your kitty. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
David Coventry joined me from his home on the side of a hill in Wellington, New Zealand. The Invisible Mile is available from Amazon and other booksellers. I thought that he had some very interesting things to say and thinks about things very deeply. The book is well written, beautifully written, very literary, as I said right at the beginning. I really appreciate him taking time to talk with me today. We're going to take another break, and then it's back for my annual encore presentation of Maynard Hirshhorn's short story, Nice Wheels. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, so you can sit back, grab your adult beverage, and turn down the lights. Listen to one of my all-time favorite tales about bicycle wheels told by its author, Maynard Hirshhorn.
Thanks, Diane. This is called Nice Wheels. Bob turned the sign to closed and clicked off the outside light. He went back to the bench and the stand and the half-trued wheel. Last one out of there as usual, he thought, turning the wheel a quarter turn each way, not yet touching it with the tool. He liked working after closing, without noise or distractions or people waiting for their stuff. He liked knowing he could think about whatever he wanted to and could take his time with the work, no clock ticking. He heard tapping at the door, saw it was Eric, and motioned him to come in. Not locked, he mouthed, nodding and making door-opening movements. Eric came in looking puzzled. He had a Campin YOLO box tucked under his arm. Hubs, maybe. I was rooting around in the dumpster for an old rim to stretch a saw up on. And look what I found, Eric said. And handed Bob a Chorus hub set. 9-speed. 32H scrawled on the top in black marker, Bob's writing, and one of Bob's price tags stuck on the end. Eric shook his head, wearily waved goodnight, and left. Unwilling to believe what he saw, Bob stared at the box. He looked up at the shelf where the hubs should have been, and by golly, they weren't there. No. Until a moment ago, they were in the dumpster. Only someone working for me would leave this box in the dumpster after sneaking it out of the store. Anyone else would have taken these hubs right home. An employee might leave them out there, then come back after closing, after midnight maybe, and grab them when no one would see. If someone found them out there, it could be an accident. Why, they must have fallen into the wastebasket by mistake and ended up in the dumpster with the rest of the junk. Sure, lucky you found them. Geez, Bob said out loud, someone's taken stuff from the shop. whoever did this wouldn't leave that box out there longer than they had to, he thought. Must have been someone who worked today. Imagining one of his guys stealing, having to play detective and figure out who it was, made Bob tired. I don't want to do this, he thought. I sell the guy's stuff 10% over cost. If they can't pay now, they pay little by little out of their checks. If they need to borrow something of mine, they know they just have to ask. If they need my help, whatever it is, they just have to ask. Especially if they're riding their bikes a lot, riding every day or training and racing. I'll do about anything to help. Still, here was serious evidence that one of his guys was stealing. Bob opened the box and took out the rear hub. He turned the axle and felt the grease-slowed smoothness of the bearings, spun the cassette body, and listened to the Paul's ratchet inside. He pulled his Sutherland's manual down from the shelf above the bench and leafed through it, found the pages he wanted, and did some arithmetic in pencil inside the lid of the Campy box. He bent down to boxes under the bench and counted out butted stainless spokes in three links, dunked the threaded ends into a bottle of spoke prep. He tamped the wet ends on a rag and spread the spokes out on the bench to dry. He scooped a handful of spoke nipples out of another box, found two 32-hole Mavic Aero clincher rims, and unwrapped them, laying them gently on the bench. He laced spokes onto both of the Campy hubs, threaded the spokes into the holes in the rims, and screwed on the nipples a few turns. Once, while he was mindlessly starting nipples onto spokes, he found himself wondering who the hell had taken the hubs. He made himself stop thinking like that. Stop, Bob. And went on building the wheels. He took the customer's wheel out of the stand and hung it on a hook. He chucked the newly laced front wheel into the stand and took his time making it fine, tight, and true. He took it out of the stand and squeezed the spokes together. He put the wheel on the floor to stress it out, then put it back in the stand and touched it up, just right. He got a Velox cotton rim strip and a Phillips screwdriver. He put the Phillips through the valve hole in a tape and the valve hole in the rim, then stretched the tape around the rim, tight and straight. He dusted the rim strip with talc, found two lightweight tubes and two light folding road clinchers. He sprinkled talc on the tube, put one of the tubes and one of the tires on the rim. He put in 40 pounds with a floor pump, checked the bead, and ran it up to 100. He built the rear wheel in the same methodical way, installed the other rim strip, tube, and tire, and put in 110 pounds per square inch. He found a 1223 Campy cog set, lightly greased the cassette body, slipped the cogs and spacers on, and tightened the lock nut. Nice wheels, he said. And they were. Nice wheels. He chucked the customer wheel back in the stand so he'd remember to work on it first thing. He turned off the fluorescence above the shop and rechecked that the back door was locked. He got his jacket and tidied up the bench, turned out lights, turned on other lights, walked to the front door and set the alarm. Carrying the fine new wheels out with him, he turned to lock the door within the seconds the alarm allowed. He peered through the glass, past the Power Bar sticker and the Oakley sticker and the GT sticker, and saw that all was just as it should be. As he passed the dumpster on the way to his old truck, he lifted the lid and gently put the wheels inside. As he lowered the lid, glare from a streetlight glinted off one of the hubs. Nice wheels, he thought, and they were nice wheels.
I hope you enjoyed that story. It always makes me smile and nod and think about what it is that makes me happy to be in the bicycle world. I'd like to thank Keith Laughlin from Rails to Trails and author David Coventry for joining me on the show this week. And I hope you have a lovely holiday. Don't drink too much of that eggnog. Thank you for listening. Stay safe. And if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.